You are listening to The Game Plan on the official Raiders podcast network. Here's your host, JT the Brick.
Welcome to The Game Plan podcast on the Raiders podcasting network. I'm your host, JT, as we get you set for the Raiders versus the Broncos. Christmas Eve, December 24th, 5:15 p.m. Pacific, at the famed Oakland Alameda County Coliseum, week 16 of The Game Plan. As I begin, happy holidays to you and your family. Thanks for downloading the podcast. Not only this week, but all week long, we are loaded once again this week. We'll talk to one of the fastest players to ever live. The great Willie Gault will join us, and he's a part of Monday Night Football and the halftime performances and the concerts all year long. So Willie will check in. Paul Gutierrez, the Raiders reporter from ESPN, really looking forward to talking to him as he's embedded with the team and provides so much content from week to week. And one of the hardest hitting safeties of all time, the 2-time Super Bowl champion, the 8-time Pro Bowler from the Denver Broncos. He's also a radio host in Denver, Steve Atwater, all going to join us on this week's edition of The Game Plan. As always, we start off with news and notes and we take a look at the last game. Gabe Jackson's on IR, another player who's injured. The Raiders all year long have been fighting through injuries, let alone all the changes to the roster. Players being released, players being traded, players being brought in and elevated from the practice squad. I think Silver and Black Productions and Raiders.com have done an amazing job of keeping you up to date with all of these transactions and what Coach Gruden's trying to do here the last couple of weeks to bring in players to get a look at them before he decides what's going to happen going into the offseason. But getting back to what happened in Cincinnati, I think the Raiders had a poor effort, quite frankly, against the Bengals. They started off slow. They were down 17-0 early in that game and got buried early. But the good news was another Lee Smith touchdown.
Martin is a running back, set behind Smith. Carr's underneath center. Play action, going to throw it wide open. Touchdown, Raiders! This time they go to Lee Smith. Another tight end for the score. And that'll get the boys lifted back up.
Yeah, for the last couple of weeks, Brett Musburger on the call, he hasn't been covered. And that's some unique play calling down at the goal line from John Gruden to Derek Carr to getting the ball to Lee Smith. The Raiders ended up losing that game by a score of 30-16. Overall, I don't think they got off to a good start, clearly trailing 17-0. And then as Coach Gruden talked about all year long, when it comes to down and distance, being from behind, having to abandon the run, pass protection again was an issue. They had breakdowns on special teams. That was a disappointing loss, considering they had momentum coming off the Steelers win. So the Raiders lose that game, and they get ready for Monday Night Football coming up against the Denver Broncos. After that game, Coach Gruden talked about how difficult it is right now with all the players who are coming and going and the injuries to get this team together to play great.
We fumbled the ball on a running play. We had some penalties. We were unable to convert on third down. We got to run the ball more. We got to run it better. But it's hard to function right now with a lot of the moving parts that we have. It's a credit to our team for moving the ball and keeping us in the game.
I think that soundbite tells you a lot. You can hear the frustration in Coach Gruden's voice, but he's trying to be positive at the end about the players who are stepping up, especially the players who are playing through injuries, who are nicked up and banged up and continue to go out there. And then the young rookies who are going to make mistakes. They were drafted to play. That's one thing that Coach Gruden has been talking about all year. The young players who are drafted, who are going to be here as building blocks long-term, are going to stay in these games, even if they're not at 100%, and try to go out there and play at a high level. Again, this offensive line has been banged up all year long. It's a credit to Derek Carr, who continues to play as he's running, as he's trying not to get sacked, as he's trying to look downfield. Coach Gruden talked about it.
I think Derek's played great. You know, somebody told me he had 3,700 yards and 68% completions in 13 games. It's astonishing, you know, with three new guards and, you know, losing a right tackle, a feature back, three top receivers. Guy's a hell of a player. Guy's a great quarterback.
He is a great quarterback, and there's been a lot of adversity this year. And you haven't seen Derek Carr flinch at all when it comes to leadership. Think about Derek for a second. He's getting paid a lot of money, but it's a tough job being a franchise quarterback, especially this year with all the transactions and the injuries. and the players that he doesn't have that he thought he'd have in Napa. So I credit Derek Carr for continually to want to play at a high level, play through adversity, and try to lead this team week in and week out. Now we move on to the Denver Broncos, who come in eliminated from the postseason at 6-8, but clearly understand this rivalry. Once again, it's Raiders week, and they care about that. I often say that the Raiders have three rivals when you look at the Chargers, the Broncos, and Kansas City. All three of those teams despise the Raiders and think that the Raiders are each's number one rival. You ask a Raider player or the team, who's your number one rival? It's split. Some say Kansas City, some might say Denver. But when you ask Denver, it's the Raiders, and they want to beat them, and they're coming in on Monday Night Football for what could be the last game ever played at the Oakland Alameda County Coliseum for the Raiders. Now, I am downplaying that here because no one has any accurate information at this time. And a lot of the media this week have been stirring the pot, looking for content, and talking about potentially this being the last game, which could be right. Depending on what happens with the city of Oakland and the Raiders, what they decide on with the lease, what the Raiders initially offered and pulled off the table, the lawsuit against the league, it's very complicated, and there is no breaking news. And when you hear it, you'll hear it here at Raiders.com. But is there a chance that this will be the last game? Absolutely, because they move into the new stadium in Las Vegas in 2020, and everybody's hoping there's another year in Oakland, and I believe there will be. I'm hoping that cooler heads prevail, and the Raiders and the city are able to negotiate, and they're able to figure out a way to play one more season there. So Coach Gruden will have another shot in Oakland with an improved football team coming off the draft. And the great Raider Nation will have an opportunity to say goodbye next year and plan accordingly. But it is Christmas Eve. It's a very emotional game. And John Gruden talked about his emotional connection to the stadium.
Yeah, I mean, I got a lot. You know, I'm really sensitive about hearing that. It's going to be a great atmosphere Monday night, Christmas Eve. Denver Broncos coming to town. I get excited thinking about it. Just raging in the black hole, rocking and raging down there after the Steeler game, after a lot of wins over the years. You know, seeing a lot of the old highlights of the great Raider teams. I get excited. I get emotional about it. And hopefully we get it all resolved where we can continue to play here.
That's exactly what I say. Hopefully this gets resolved. I know the Raider Nation wants it to get resolved. The Raiders would like it to get resolved. And we're playing football in Oakland next year. For Coach Gruden, the stadium means a lot to him. Even though it's outdated and the Raiders will have a new stadium in years to come, it holds a special place in his heart.
It's a real football stadium. It's dirt, grass. It's got tradition. It's where some of the best games in history of football have been played. It's where some of the best players in the history of the world played the football games at. You know, you're walking around before the Steeler game, you see Franco Harris and Lester Hayes, and you think about some of the battles they had in that place. Reggie Jackson lighting the torch. I mean, there's a lot of things that have happened in that stadium.
Tremendous history at the Coliseum. We all know that. And hopefully this game on Monday Night Football will live up to the hype of this rivalry. Earlier in the week, Pro Bowl announcements. The Raiders have three alternates in tight end Jared Cook, center Rodney Hudson, and guard tackle Kelechi Osemele. Three alternates for the silver and black. As we take a look at the Broncos come in riding the high of a couple of their young players and their Pro Bowl selections. This team is not highly ranked, very similar to the Raiders when it comes to their offense. Their rushing offense is ranked 11th. They're running it for about 123 yards a game compared to the Raiders, who are just below 100 at 99 yards a game. Passing, when you look at the passing offense, the Raiders are ranked 14th at 244 yards a game, 229 for the Broncos, who are ranked 19th. The stat that jumps out as we head into this Monday night game is the Broncos' defense, points per game. They're only giving up 21.4. They're solid on special teams. They don't make a lot of mistakes. Their total defense is ranked pretty much identical to the Raiders. They're 25th. The Raiders are 26th. But again, they are a bend-don't-break defense. They give up field goals, not a lot of touchdowns, at only 21.4 a game. And I like the direction that John Elway is going in with the draft and what they've done with Bradley Chubb, running back Philip Lindsay, How about this? He becomes the first undrafted offensive rookie to make it to the Pro Bowl. So that's an exciting story. They have a running back who is not only good as an undrafted rookie, he's a Pro Bowler, and he made history. So the Raiders are going to have to do a pretty good job. Like we've said all year, teams are going to want to run the ball on the Raiders early and often. And if they could set up the run and run it effectively, like many teams have been able to do, the Raiders are dead last in rushing defense, 32nd in the league, giving up 146 yards a game. Teams want to establish the run to set up the pass. That will be the game plan again for Denver on Monday Night Football. And for Denver, again, what I'm finding impressive about this team going forward, they started off slow. They made a push midseason. Now they're mathematically eliminated, but they're trying to get their young players in, get them the reps, very similar to what the Raiders are trying to do going forward. So you got a rivalry game on Monday Night Football. You got a big game. You got the Coliseum on a holiday and the last Monday Night Football game of the year. It should be explosive. The tailgating will be outstanding. And again, thanks to all the great Raider fans who have shown up for all of these games, got behind this team. There was a lot of adversity this year, but coming into the final home game of the year, I want to tip my cap to the Raider Nation once again, if not one of the top and most impressive fan bases in all of football. Our first guest on the game plan is one of the greatest safeties of all time. Steve Atwater is a two-time Super Bowl champion, an eight-time Pro Bowler, a two-time first-team All-Pro. He's in the Denver Broncos Ring of Honor and a member of the NFL's 1990s All-Decade team. Steve, thanks for coming on the Game Plan podcast. I really appreciate you making this happen.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on. Looking forward to it.
Let's jump right in with the Pro Bowl, which was announced earlier this week. And your opinion of that game, because that game meant a lot to you. As an eight-time Pro Bowler, a two-time first-team All-Pro, that was something that was important to your legacy. What was it like when you heard the announcement that you were a Pro Bowler year after year?
Oh, man. I remember my first year getting voted to the Pro Bowl was my sophomore season, my second year, 1990, and I was so happy just to, you know, I was happy to even to be in the NFL, but then to be, you know, voted by my peers and coaches into the Pro Bowl, it just made it that much sweeter, and I was very appreciative, and, you know, yeah, we played the game hard, and the game has changed quite a bit since then, though. It's a little less physicality now than it was back in the day, but I think it's all for the betterment of the game and guys' overall health.
Steve, why did it work out? I know it wasn't easy for you, but when you came out in the first round, the 20th pick overall to the Broncos, who was your mentors? Talk about the coaches back then and why you hit the ground running so quickly and was able to pick up the speed of the NFL.
Well, first off, as soon after the draft as possible, I flew out to Denver. I didn't even attend my graduation, and you know, I came up to Denver and just got started with my off-season workouts. I believe it was at the beginning of May, and back then we didn't have the limits that the NFL imposes on teams now in terms of the restrictions on the amount of time that players could spend at the facilities and with coaches and doing stuff on the field. So I got a chance to go through the entire off-season workout program and got a chance to spend a great deal of time with my defensive backs coach, who was Charlie Waters. And I learned a lot from actually a guy who was in town, Mike Harden. He was the guy who eventually got released that year, and he signed with the Raiders and played that year with the Raiders in my rookie year. But he just took me under his wings and taught me everything he knew. And then, of course, once training camp started, being in the meeting room with Dennis Smith, Carl Mecklenburg, and those guys, I was just I'll be in the meeting rooms quiet. I'd ask a lot of questions, but I wouldn't comment too much. I was just trying to soak up all the knowledge and, you know, just tried to bring my intensity to the game once I got onto the field.
Steve Atwater's our guest, the NFL legend, part of the all-decade team of the 1990s. Can you talk about the physicality of the sport now that you see Broncos practices today and you see minicamp, OTAs, obviously training camp, and what it was like when you came into the league, the physicality of camp and practice, the days that you had in pads, and the offenses that you were going up against, and so many great players, including John Elway. What was a typical day like for you, if you could share a story, practicing back in the day?
Yeah, practices were tough. And I remember, you know, we had two-a-days, and, you know, some days we would have padded practices, both of those practices throughout the day. And, you know, of course, going up against John Elway, Bobby Humphrey, he was a rookie my rookie season. He was, you know, learning the system, and, you know, we had a chance to grow together there that first year. But it was just a lot of time spent, again, learning the system, and then, you know, going out and practicing what you learn, and spend a bunch of time in the meeting rooms going over the film, breaking down things you did wrong. And for me, I was more of a kind of a system guy, in terms of I always had a method of processing everything, and I tried to do it the same way pretty much on every down. First I looked to the sidelines to see what personnel they had, and then I'd have to, get the call from our defense, and then, you know, based on the defense, I know, you know, where I line up, either to the tight end or away from the tight end, and then I look, you know, glance over and see the split that the receiver has, and I'll make sure that I'm, you know, where I need to be for that particular defense. And, you know, all these different things, it was just kind of a checklist that I got down to where I could do everything really quickly. And, you know, sometimes when I look at football now, I don't know if some players go through a process on every play, because, you know, I see guys missing things that they shouldn't miss. But, yeah, all that was a part of the learning process. And, again, I had some great guys that I was able to learn from. Again, I think one of the biggest was my mentor and compadre, Dennis Smith. It was just, you know, such an honor to, you know, share the defensive backfield with him for so many years. And, again, I learned so much from him. And not only the X's and O's, but just the intensity with which he played the game. He and Carl Mecklenburg and a lot of guys on our team, it was just so inspiring that, you know, you see those guys going out, land on the line, and, you know, I wanted to be like them. So I just tried to follow suit.
Steve, before we get to the rivalry with the Raiders, one of your greatest hits came on Monday Night Football, September 17th, 1990, when you hit Christian Okoye in the hole from the Kansas City Chiefs. I see that highlight all the time. I YouTubed it before the interview, and that was Monday Night Football before there was Thursday Night Football and obviously Sunday Night Football. What did it mean for you to strap on that helmet to play Monday Night Football back in the day, and how important it was for you to shine on that stage?
Yeah, it was big, and I remember, you know, my rookie year, we played a Monday night game, and I was so excited because I watched Monday Night Football all through college and high school, and I was like, man, I'm gonna be on TV. You know, it's gonna be a big game, and everybody back home is gonna be able to see it. So I was pretty fired up. But as you know, once the whistle blows and everything goes live, the focus kind of narrows, and you know, just had to concentrate on what the opponent was doing. But yeah, that was. It was definitely a big deal to play my first Monday night game. And over the course of my career, we were fortunate that we had, you know, good teams to where every year we played a game or two on Monday night.
Steve Atwater's our guest. All right, let's get right to it. This should be good. Give me the Raider rivalry going into Monday Night Football. What does it mean to you? The rivalry with Al Davis, dating back to the fans in the black hole, to the players that you went up against. Give me some Raider stories, some good ones.
Oh, man. Hey, I remember, man, from early on, you know, I learned that, hey, we do not like Raiders here in Broncos country. That lasted throughout my career, and that continues on to this day. Now, for a period of time, I think we kind of got the best of the Raiders, and for a period of time, I think the Raiders got the best of us. So You know, right now, I think we're both kind of languishing at the bottom of the AFC West. So I anticipate this game being one that we're a lot of anger and a lot of, you know, it'll show the passion from both sides, just, you know, how deep this rivalry runs, especially knowing that, hey, neither team is making the playoffs this year. It's Christmas Eve. Everybody wants to be home with their families. It's the last game that will be played at the stadium there in Oakland, and I would imagine that there may be some fans at the game that, you know, have a little bit extra activity or a little bit extra motivation to, you know, scream a little louder and make this rivalry, you know, even, you know, just stand up to what it's been over the years. I'm sorry, go ahead.
It's about pride. It's about pride with these fan bases and these two organizations. They have a lot to play for because of the history of the organizations and the fact that it's Monday Night Football. Possibly it could be the last game. A lot of Oakland fans hope they come back and play there next year. But, hey, you were able to do it, and you played on two championship teams. Sometimes when you're out of it, you play for pride and you give the fans what they deserve, the paying customers.
Oh, I agree 100%, and I expect nothing less. I know the guys, they always say, yeah, you know, we're getting paid, we're professionals. But at the end of the day, I remember listening to Ronnie Lott many years ago, and someone had asked him about, you know, how he goes out and lays on the line. And he says, really, it's about respect. At the end of the game, you want your opponent to respect you. When you go and you go high five and give everybody five on the other team, you want that person to look at you in the eye, regardless of the outcome of the game, and say, man, look, you played a hell of a game. Now, if they don't do that, if they look at you and like, ah, man, get out of here. You know, you gave half effort. I don't respect you. That would be, I would imagine, that would be a pretty bad feeling. But I learned early on, I'd much rather have guys win, lose, or draw. At the end of the game, they come over and say, man, hey, good job. Way to work. And that felt good. Even in a losing situation, that I could always lean on that. Hey, man, at least I did the best I could do. These guys still respect me.
Well, Steve, thanks for spending time. The compliment that I'd like to give you is I saw Lawrence Taylor in his prime. I saw Ronnie Lott play. You look at the greatest defensive players of all time. In the prime of your career and in your 8 Pro Bowls and those 2 Super Bowls, you're as good as any player that I've ever seen live with the way you were a pro, how hard you hit, and just the way you brought it every time and always left it on the field. I really appreciate your time. Enjoy the holiday, and thanks for previewing Monday Night Football with us.
Hey, Jay-Z, thank you so much, man. I hope it's a great game. Merry Christmas and happy holiday to you and all your listeners. And thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Really appreciate Steve Atwater joining us. The Raiders had the legendary Jack Tatum, and the Broncos have Steve Atwater. I'd highly recommend you YouTube some of his hits to see how ferocious of a player he was. Great catching up with him. All right, our next guest on the Game Plan podcast is one of the best reporters covering the Raiders, period. He's embedded with the team. His content is tremendous. He covers the silver and black for ESPN, Paul Gutierrez. Paul, appreciate you coming on. Thanks for doing this.
Hey, my pleasure, JT. Good to talk to you.
Great talking to you. Let's jump in first with Gabe Jackson going on IR. And from your perspective this season, on how many players went on IR, how many players have come and gone, even players that were let go and were re-signed, how difficult of a task was it for you covering all these transactions?
Well, it's probably no more difficult for me than it was for the coaches to try to get these guys up and running. And really, that's my question these last 2 weeks of the season is how fair of an assessment can the coaches do on this roster? I mean, this offensive line 2 years ago was one of the best in the NFL. Now it's a patchwork unit out there, especially with the interior of the line. And then you gotta put that then on to Derek Carr. While he is playing efficient, it's not explosive, and he's getting sacked a whole lot of times. But how fair is it to judge him based on all these injuries? I mean, when you crack down on all these numbers, JT, right here and now, only 7 guys on this 53-man roster were Reggie McKenzie picks before John Gruden came aboard. And then beyond that, 39 of them, if I'm counting right, did not play a single snap last season for the Raiders. So when you're talking about turnover and fixing this roster going forward, those are the numbers right there that stand out to me.
I think that's a great point you make on how you evaluate players. Let's stay with Derek Carr, who has been very efficient when it comes to the streak without an interception. Very impressive, and he's out there. When he gets hit, he gets right back up. He wants to stay in all these games. Let's talk about his efficiency working with John Gruden. Give me some of the positives that you've seen covering Derek Carr every day.
Well, I think the positives is something. There was a switch that was flipped midway in the season, maybe around the bye week, because at that point, remember, you look at it and it seemed like, and this is actually what I'm writing this week, is it seemed like the two of them, and Derek being a biblical man, it seemed like they were standing at the Tower of Babel. You know, they were speaking in tongues, they couldn't really understand each other, and then they had the little mini sideline skirmish in Arizona, and from that point forward, Derek has really kind of. You've seen a little bit of that bravado, some of that gunslinger that he had a couple of years ago. And he acknowledged. He said that John Gruden told him, hey, man, let's not take your right arm out of this. Let's just let you, you know, I'm going to give you 50 things to think about instead of 100. And just go out there and play. And it's true, because early in the season, it seemed like Derek was playing not just to win, but it seemed like he was playing to please John Gruden rather than playing to play. It seems the opposite now, and he's still taking, you know, he's still doing a lot of checkdowns and being careful with the ball and not throwing the interceptions as good. But, you know, through those first six games, Carr had a 40.9 total QBR, 7 touchdowns, 8 picks. Since then, the QBR is 56.6, 12 touchdowns, no interceptions. So you're seeing a growth, you're seeing the familiarity, a comfort level in this offense that I think John Gruden likes, as well as Derek Carr.
I've always been a big Derek Carr guy, from watching him in the building and his attitude and how he cares so much about his teammates. Were you ever skeptical at any point in the season where he wouldn't be a fit with John Gruden long term, considering a lot of the Reggie McKenzie players are no longer on the team?
Oh, yeah. I think when the trade deadline was coming down and there were rumors that Jacksonville might need a quarterback or the New York Giants might need a quarterback. And you know, if the price was right, anybody on that roster was good to go. You know, that's what you were hearing when you see Khalil Mack get traded, when you see Amari Cooper get traded. Yeah, I mean, I don't think it had much to do with if he was a Reggie McKenzie pick or not, but just it didn't look like it was working at that point. And then he sticks through the trade deadline, and then he starts playing better. So I think that was a real test for both Gruden and for Carr to see how is this thing going to go. Now, I'm not saying that he's going to be the guy for years to come here, because, you know, we do know how John loves his veteran quarterbacks that are out there and would like to fight with him, so to speak, and Derek's personality is a little different than that. But I think what we're seeing here now is the promise of, you know, one more year together with each other, and Derek can really take off. Because the only other time that he had the same offensive system in place was in 2016. And what happened that year, besides the broken leg? Yeah, he finished tied for third in NFL MVP voting. So I think that is what Raiders fans and the coaching staff really hopes happens next year.
Paul Gutierrez is our guest, ESPN Raiders reporter. So here on the game plan, I like to look ahead at the upcoming opponent, but when we look back at the Cincinnati game, coming off the Steelers' victory and how emotional it was, and the fact that Arizona and Pittsburgh were great wins where the team really rallied, you saw in the locker room and you saw afterwards that the team wants to win. All the background noise about draft picks and they don't want to win because they want to secure a high draft pick. When you see these players, and you do such a great job every day in that locker room when you have media availability to see that these players want to win. What happened in Cincinnati? Down 17-0, that slow start, they dug a hole they couldn't dig out of.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what happened. And you know, especially it's the 10 a.m. kickoff for your body clock. And I know that can be used as an excuse for everybody, and they'll never use it, but that is the fact. They got off to a slow start. They made it interesting, and special teams failed them. So it goes back to a constant theme that has been going on this season, is you'll have two aspects playing well and then one won't, or the offense will play well, the defense will fold, you know, the other way around. And I think that's what happened with that long kickoff return. They're right there, they're ready to make a run, and boom, here you go, the game's over, just like that. So, and also with the injuries, I mean, the game to me is won and lost in the trenches. And when you got two guys in Chaz Green and Denzel Good, who Raider fans literally have to look up in their scorecard, they can't even look them up in the media guys because they're not in there because they're so new. I mean, what does that tell you? The things are happening down low in the trenches that just are not good, and there's an unfamiliarity there that you know, really kind of came up and bit them. And with Gabe Jackson now on IR, you know, the only hope is that Kaleche Osemele come out there and play against the Broncos this week to keep some sort of of familiarity in the offensive line.
Paul, when I first met John Gruden and he was winning with the Raiders, he was a guy that would just walk on the field, run to the black hole. Everybody loved his energy. Now that he comes back the second time around and the team is struggling, I can see it in his face. He's trying hard every day to stay positive because that's how he is in his life. But this has been such a grind for him this year, bringing in all these players and the evaluation process from Mac to Cooper to saying goodbye to Reggie. What differences have you seen with John Gruden the last month as the team has been proving that they're playing really hard for him?
Yeah, I've seen that he's actually kind of exhaled a little bit, JT. Yeah. It's funny because, you know, he came in and he was still the TV personality. You know, he came in and I was at Ricky's that day when he had the fan rally, and the guy could walk on water. He could do no wrong at that place. And then as the season went on, they took the trade of Khalil Mack, some of the more curious decisions, Amari Cooper being traded, which, again, you look at it, okay, well, now you got three first-rounders. Okay, we can figure this out as we go along from the fans' perspective. And then the losses just keep piling up and piling up. You can see that it was grinding on him, that it was wearing on him. But now they're seeing some success. You know, the fruits of their labor are starting to come up a little bit, especially by beating the Steelers. And you saw that the way that John ran over to the black hole and celebrated for a second. And a lot of people across the league didn't understand it. Well, then you haven't been paying attention because he is so tightly wound and so tight with the fans here anyway. And we talked to him this week about this potentially being the last game in Oakland. And he got a little choked up talking about the different memories and games that were in this stadium. It's almost like, yeah, it's a dump, but it's our dump kind of a situation. And I think just from seeing what John's doing, he's kind of relaxed. He's exhaled. And he knows with all the changes in the roster and with the injuries, there's only so much he can do. That's not to make an excuse, but that's just where it is right here and now.
Well, you were just in Vegas, and you know with the stadium being built, that's 2020. And when it comes to next season, everybody's wondering out loud what's going to happen. You and I know that no one knows at this point. A negotiation is going to be ongoing, but Roger Goodell put it on the clock. What are you sensing either way? Because I understand how the Raiders would not want to make this and publicize this is the last game if it's not going to be. If I had to hedge a bet, I think they would be back and cooler heads would prevail and they'd come together with the city of Oakland and the county and find a way to play there. What are you sensing?
Yeah, that's exactly it, JT. You know, it's very similar to when the Sacramento Kings were playing their last game at Arco, and it seemed like they were getting ready to move to Seattle, right? And yet they stayed. They got their stadium. Now, the Raiders aren't going to stay here for the long term, but it does make the most sense to just, you know what, suck it up, play here one last year. I know the Raiders pulled their $7.5 million lease offer off the table, but as Mark Davis has told me, he would much rather stay here. He can't do it to the fans again. And fans would kind of say, well, wait a minute, what are you talking about? You're leaving us anyway. Well, he wants to stay one last year. I know San Diego is very intriguing. Reno is very intriguing, actually, too. Glendale, Arizona could be a possibility. I think it's everything but Las Vegas a year early because they want to get there and have the red carpet, the grand splash opening. But what makes the most sense to me, and when I kind of go back and forth, depending on what I hear hour by hour, is that it seems like they really should and want to still make it happen in Oakland.
Paul Gutierrez, as we wrap it up, the evaluation process of the offseason and all of these college players and the potential new GM and what that GM needs to see to help John Gruden along the way, to me, it is fascinating. And you've studied the history of the Raiders. You've written a book about it. And when you look at the history of Al Davis and evaluating the draft, there is a lot of passion in this organization to concentrate on bringing in the best players. Now, there is a premium on that. It has to hit. It has to be great. Talk about what you expect to cover in the offseason outside the stadium issue and how important it is that John Gruden hits the ground after the Kansas City game in regards to evaluating great young players.
Well, that's it exactly. The draft is the lifeblood of a team, and with all the changeover that's happened here, they, as it stands now, have 10 draft picks, three of which are in the first round, two in the seventh, and I expect them to get at least one, possibly two, maybe even three comp picks. You're looking at up to 13 draft picks to help restock this roster to what John Gruden wants and likes. The flip side of that is they better hit. They better nail those early picks especially and address those needs, whether it's a pass rusher, a playmaking wide receiver, another offensive lineman, a safety, whatever they need. They need to hit these guys. And I know the draft is a crapshoot, and every team could say that anyway. But for what this team is doing going forward, that should be the main football side of things objective, is to nail this draft. And when you look back, you couldn't really say that John had much success in Tampa Bay when he was running the draft there. Of 90 players that he drafted, only three were Pro Bowlers later on. So something there has got to improve, and that's where they need to really focus their efforts going forward as far as putting the product on the field.
Before Reggie left, I understood up in Napa the process of signing free agents to short one-year deals because they wouldn't be back, and that would just give them more cap space. Now I'm fascinated with your opinion on what's going to happen in free agency. Do you go out and get one-year players again because Vegas is looming, or do you get the best of the best free agents because the cap space will be huge and they can lock up those free agents by telling them, we want to win, we want to do great in Oakland in the final year if they're there, but we want you comfortable hitting the ground knowing you're a member of this team in Vegas?
Yeah, and I think that's the direction they have to take. I mean, it's, you know, John does have the 10-year contract, and as Mark Davis told me, he's not going anywhere. He is the one constant in this organization. So that, to me, is the fascinating part of this process as well, is how do you pitch that to free agents, especially the elite ones that have families, and they're like, wait a minute, am I signing to play in Oakland or Reno or San Diego or parts unknown and then going to Las Vegas? I mean, what are we doing here? So that is going to be something, and that question is going to be answered, obviously, because the NFL needs to know where the Raiders are going to play in 2019 by early February at the latest. So that right there, is it depends upon what the free agent really is up for. And if they're up for playing, you know, 1 year somewhere and then going on to Vegas, that's where they need to focus the attention to. I think they need to go all in and get as many guys as possible.
Last question. I know you interact with fans. I see in the parking lot, you travel on the road, you're on the ground with the silver and black. Let's end with the fans' perspective on what they've been through this year, the loyalty, and what's in store Christmas Eve for the last home game of the year.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting, especially being on Christmas Eve against a rival in the Broncos, a night game. It's going to be surreal. And from the fan perspective, I think they feel, you know, at this point they've accepted it. I think early on they're like, wait a minute, this roster only needed a good scrubbing. It didn't need to be blown up. And yet that's what happened. So I think their loyalty is still there. There are a lot of people that I talk to that have washed their hands and they've moved on. And yet there's others that I really do talk to on the record anyway. And they're like, you know what, they're my team wherever they are. So it hurts, especially for them to leave them a second time in the Bay Area. But having been in Las Vegas, I mean, I think the best quote that I was given by somebody in Las Vegas was the head of a booster club there. And he told me, his name is Joe Perea, he told me, you know what, it sucks for Oakland, but don't blame Las Vegas. It's not our fault.
Paul, I greatly appreciate your time and work. You do an unbelievable job. Happy holidays. I'll talk to you soon.
Same to you, JT. Thanks.
Check out all of Paul Gutierrez's work at ESPN.com. We appreciate his time. Our final guest is one of the fastest football players to ever live and a Raider legend, Willie Gault. Played for the Chicago Bears from 83 to 87, and then the move to the Los Angeles Raiders from 88 to 93. He is a Super Bowl champion with the Bears and one of the fastest players to ever play when it came to special teams, and as one of the breakaway wide receivers out of Tennessee. We welcome him to the Game Plan Podcast. Willie, good catching up with you again. Thank you.
My pleasure, JT. How are you, buddy?
Couldn't be better. Before we get going, I want to ask you if you could share with our listeners your training regimen. I was in the car with you with a couple other VIPs who were with us, and you were explaining how you work out every day in anticipation for still running and doing this. Can you walk us through a typical day, a week, or a month, and how you still train?
Well, training for me is like life, because you know, you only get one life, basically, only one body. You can't trade it in like a car, so you have to treat it with dignity and respect. And I want to be able to do the same things I'm doing now when I'm 80, 70, 80, whatever. So I think it's important to treat your body that way. So, I mean, I lift in the morning. I get up around 5:30. I go to the gym at 7. I'm at the gym until 9. I'm at the track from 9 to about 11, 11:30, 12. I do, you know, all full body workouts, and then I go to the track and I run sprints. I do the stairs. I do push-ups, sit-ups, dips. I run workouts, and I treat it like I was when I was playing. I do the same type of workouts, but now it's a little bit more intense because, you know, I'm older, so I do more. And also, I have the pleasure to work out with some Olympians, and so we make for a great team. We keep each other young. They're much younger than I am, of course. I'm double their age, but I keep up with them and, you know, I hang out with them, so it keeps me young.
Can you share your age with us?
I'm older than 30. and I'm not quite 50 yet.
Okay.
I'm 58, right?
58 years old, and the amount of track work that you put in, because I think a lot of people are listening and they say the sprinting aspect of this. We know you as a sprinter and a fast football player. How is sprinting still a part of your life, and what type of wear and tear is that on your body?
Well, I've never stopped sprinting, so it's not a big deal to me. I think if you stop doing it, then it's a really big deal. It's hard. It's really hard on your body. But, you know, I've taken care of my body over these years. I've never drank, never smoked, never done drugs, so I don't have that issue to deal with. And I've never stopped training. So for me, it's like walking. And it gives me my energy. It gives me my youth, and it makes me feel good. And I do it. So, but I have no problem sprinting. We still do 60s, 80s, 100s, 150s, 200s, 300s, 400s. You know, so it's pretty interesting. Now is the off season, so we're training to start to run in March or April. We have to train now to run there. So it's a good four or five months of training to be able to run and at your maximum speed later.
Willie, before we get to football questions, I'm sure a lot of people's ears peak up when they hear, never any alcohol, no drugs, and no cigarettes. It's rare that I could talk to an athlete who says that. There's a few of them. Was there peer pressure when you were a kid? Was it parenting? What was the point in your life where you said, I'm never going down that road?
Oh, there was so much peer pressure, but I didn't really mind because I didn't care. I sort of laughed with them. You know, they made jokes about me. I laughed. I go, you're right. I am square. No big deal, because I knew it wasn't going to help me be the person I wanted to be. And my mom and dad instilled in me, which I am so grateful for them, is that be my own person, be a leader. Do something because you want to do it. Don't do it because someone else wants you to do it. And I just never had an affinity for smoke. I thought, if I smoke enough, I drink, it's not going to help me be the best athlete I can or the best person I can, so I'm not going to do it. And consequently, you know, I didn't do it, and some of my friends around me that may have been a better athlete at the time were doing it, and their career wound up being really cut short. And I saw it, and I said, well, I think I made the right decision. So I think I had great leadership, great coaches, great principals, great teachers, and great family, and, you know, great friends. Friends who actually chastised me, and I had great enemies. So your enemies fuel you to be the person that you are also, not just your friends.
This is so good. Willie Gault joins us. I love this conversation. And you went to the University of Tennessee. You played for the Bears, the 85 legendary Bears, and the Raiders, notorious for partying, celebrating, late nights, and all that. And the discipline that was instilled with you at an early age, I'm sure this is something you speak about when you do all your motivational speaking.
Oh, absolutely. And the thing about it, I was a part of it, but I didn't take part of it. You know, I would go to parties, I just wouldn't drink. And, you know, I was always a designated driver. I would make sure people were okay because I wasn't intoxicated. And now, even in my adult life, man, when I go to a party with my friends, I'm always a driver, and they know that they can do what they want to and be safe with me because I'll take care of them. And that's a good thing, because I don't feel I've missed anything. And people go, wow, don't you think you missed something? No, I haven't missed anything. I've known everything. I see everything. And the next day is fun, because the next day I can tell them what they've done. And they go, did I really do that? And go, oh, yeah, I was there. You did it. It was funny.
Willie, when I look at your career with the Bears and the Raiders, what jumps out at me, not only your exceptional speed and play, but the coaching. Can you walk us through the best coaches that you played for, position coaches, head coaches, and the impact they had on you?
Well, I was very fortunate. I had a really good high school coach, first of all. And then, I was very privileged to play at the University of Tennessee under Coach Johnny Majors, who, of course, was a runner-up for the Heisman and a great player himself. And then, of course, I was drafted by the Bears, and Mike Bicker was there, and, you know, I had Ted Plum, who was my receiver coach, and played with a great guy like Walter Payton and, you know, Mike Singletary, Todd Bell, who was an amazing guy who we lost some years ago, Richard Dent, Otis Wilson, Dennis McKinnon, who was my teammate and fellow receiver. And when you play with guys like that who actually motivate you to be your best, I would run extra after practice with all those guys in practice, and Mike Singletary and Todd Bell, and we run routes and throw extra passes. Vince Evans, who was a quarterback there with me, we throw extra passes. I always had an affinity to try to do the best that I could. You know, I wouldn't say I was the greatest athlete in the world, but I worked hard. I would work harder than anyone else. There's no one to outwork me. I don't care what anyone says. They're not going to outwork me, and I know I'm responsible for that. I can only control what I can control. That's me working hard, me knowing my plays, and me being on time. And those are things I value as a professional. And the good thing about what I've been able to accomplish is that I can say I played 12 years in the National Football League. I never missed a game in 12 years. And I played at a high level. I wind up, I think, third all-time on the average per catch. I didn't catch a lot of passes because we didn't throw a lot in Chicago. If we had thrown a lot, I would have caught a lot, but we didn't throw a lot. And but I still did well. I led my team every year for the first 5 years in Chicago on receivings and yards. And so I felt really good about my contribution.
Willie Gault joins us. Tell us about the trade to the Raiders, because whenever we hear about a trade with Mr. Davis and the way he evaluated you, not only coming out of college, but your time with the Bears, how did it come about, and when did you first talk to him, and why was he going after you? Walk us through that trade, which was a big one at the time.
Right. Well, when I first came to L.A. to play the Raiders, the Bears, I was jogging around the field, and when I got to Mr. Davis, he stopped me. He said, "Hey, kid," I stopped him. He said, "You know, I want to tell you about this play you did here. You named three or four plays that I had done a year or two before and that I had already forgotten about. And I was really amazed that he remembered those plays. And he said, "Wow, that was really good. I want to let you know." I said, "Well, thank you very much." And we sort of had a friendship. And then the next thing I know, the next year I was up and I get a call and said, "Well, the Raiders want you. Do you want to play for the Raiders?" I go, "Yeah, of course." I mean, because L.A. is a place that's amazing. The Raiders have always had a great tradition, and you know, there was no one more knowledgeable about football than Al Davis. And I was able to come here my first year. I had Coach Mike Shanahan. He was the first-year coach here. Of course, he didn't last too long, but I had a great relationship with Mike. I thought he was an amazing coach, and I wish we'd have kept him. But then Art Shell came on, which was a historical thing because he was the first African-American coach in the National Football League, and he brought a player mentality, and I loved Art and had great teammates like Tim Brown and James Lofton. And of course, Bo Jackson came, Marcus Allen, who's one of my best friends, Howard Long was there, Greg Townsend, you know, Mervin Fernandez. I mean, the list goes on and on, just amazing guys. And to be able to play with guys like that was, you know, pretty, pretty special.
It's an incredible story, and it's in progress because you have such a big life here in front of you. You told me that you're producing these halftime shows on Monday Night Football, and there's some big artists that you brought to the table. How's that experience been?
Well, it's been amazing, and you know, we have a group of people that's called Buddha Brown, who brings artists for us and get the talent, and we just sort of put the whole thing together. We got a guy named Mike Jerkovich, who is really a great producer in his own right, and you know, we got a great team that's helping out, helping us, and you know, Bill Boyd and you know, Gary Kupke and Igor, who's here in L.A. We have a great team of people who I think it's amazing. What we're trying to do is make the Monday Night Football games like the halftime show, like a Super Bowl, where you bring a musical guest in, you make it fun. You know, it's fun, and I think it's to try to, you know, give football a different light, and I think that's what we've been able to do. And I'm really excited. We're almost at the end of the season.
Willie, finally, being around the Raiders recently and the troubles they're having this year, John Gruden has a plan. You're a winner. You've been a winner your whole life. Can you walk us through this plan on how he's accumulating draft picks along with salary cap release and how this can turn quickly for the Raiders in the next few years?
Well, I mean, you've seen it before. Look at Cleveland this year. Last year they didn't win a game, but this year, I mean, they arguably, you know, are a pretty good team, not bad. I mean, they can beat just about anyone if they play well. So the parity in the league and with the free agency and everything else, I think it's just a part of a process. And Coach Gruden, you know, he's a very smart man, and, you know, I think he knows what he's doing. And, you know, the Raiders are going through a little bit of a down spot right now, but I know they'll bounce back, and it's part of sports. I mean, the other team gets paid, too, and, you know, they put together teams, and some of them have been together for 4 or 5 years and, you know, 6 years, some of them, and this is the first year for Coach Gruden. So I think we just have to be patient and be supportive and know that the guys are going to give their best in Coach Gruden. If they're not, Coach Gruden will find the guys that will. And we're trying to carry on that tradition of Raider football and being a Raider and what that's all about. And, of course, Mark is carrying on his tradition of his father, and he'll try to do a great job and do his best that he can to help make that happen with his staff there, with Reggie and Mark Berdane and Joey Klingfield and all those guys who are doing a great job.
Thank you, Willie. I'll never forget this. Great conversation. I look forward to doing it again. Thank you so much. Good seeing you.
No problem, buddy. Anytime, my friend.
Appreciate Willie Gault and his time on a busy week where the Raiders are preparing for Monday Night Football, and he will be there out in the parking lot and on the sidelines in Oakland. That wraps up this week's edition of the Game Plan Podcast. For everyone at Silver and Black Productions, I'm JT the Brick. Have a tremendous Christmas and holiday season. We'll wrap up the regular season next week against the Kansas City Chiefs.
Thank you for listening to The Game Plan on the official Raiders Podcast Network.